WJFF in Jeffersonville. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, we'll hear from some youth voices. First, Leif Johansson and his podcast, Close to Home, a COVID-19 update from Sullivan West. Superintendent Stephen Walker talks to Leif about the latest news from this week. And we'll hear from the student journalists of Manor, Inc. They're talking about jobs in Sullivan County, gender identity, they'll have film reviews, and OC Helper's letter from the editor. That's all coming up on Radio Chatskill. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Some 3,700 Department of Transportation workers have been sent home with no pay because of the congressional impasse over infrastructure spending. NPR's Amy Held reports the Senate is due to meet today to try to end the furlough.
Many of the furloughed transportation workers are tasked with overseeing the nation's roadways. Now they find themselves caught up in the gridlock over President Biden's vast domestic spending agenda. The transportation funding is included in the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill the Senate has already passed, but the House is delaying a vote as Democrats wrangle over the much bigger social safety net and climate package. Last night, the House did approve a one-month stopgap bill to keep the transportation programs up and running. Now the Senate will seek to sign off and get the workers back on the job. Amy Held, NPR News.
Before heading to Wilmington, Delaware today, President Biden said that he will work hard to bring progressives and moderates in his party together and get both the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the much larger social spending package through Congress. Progressives want to see a deal on the larger plan to boost social spending and fight climate change before voting on the roads and bridges bill. Abortion rights advocates will be marching in D.C. and around the country today, just over a month after Texas's restrictive new abortion law went into effect. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports.
Women's March, which put on annual protests during the Donald Trump presidency, announced the marches the day after Texas's law went into effect. The organization is partnering with dozens of others to put on what they're calling rallies for abortion justice in Washington, D.C., as well as other cities nationwide. The march in D.C. will start at 11 a.m. at Freedom Plaza in downtown Washington and will go to the Supreme Court building. The Supreme Court's next term starts on Monday, and during it, justices will hear arguments over a Mississippi law banning abortion after 15 weeks. Abortion rights advocates fear that it could mean a reversal of Roe v. Wade. Abortion rights opponents are also gathering today to hold a prayer rally at the court. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Overseas, environmental protesters have blocked access to Britain's biggest private airport. Vicky Barker reports from London that protesters are trying to draw attention to the impact of private flights on climate change ahead of next month's major climate summit in Britain.
Activists from the Extinction Rebellion group, including, they say, a former airline pilot, have plunked themselves down outside all three entrances to Farnborough Airport. They're holding signs that read, "Private flights cost the earth, and 1% of people cause 50% of aviation emissions." Airport managers say the peaceful protest has not disrupted flights.
And you're listening to NPR News. Queen Elizabeth told Scottish lawmakers today that the world's attention will be focused on Scotland next month when Britain hosts a COP26 climate summit of world leaders. The Queen opened the latest session of the Scottish Parliament today. In the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte has announced his retirement from politics. In a surprise move, it could pave the way for his daughter to run for the job that he will vacate next year. Michael Sullivan reports from Thailand.
The Constitution only allows presidents a single six-year term, but Duterte had been widely expected to run for vice president in the upcoming election. In announcing his decision, he acknowledged what he called the overwhelming sentiment of Filipinos who think his vice presidential bid might circumvent the law. Attention will now be focused on a possible presidential bid by his daughter, Sarah, now the mayor of Davao City, as her father was before her, in a country long enamored with dynastic politics. Sara Duterte Carpio said as recently as last month that that only one of them would run for national office next year. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
The coronavirus pandemic has now killed more than 700,000 Americans. That tally from Johns Hopkins University was reached as health officials say the current wave is slowing down. Millions of Americans, though, remain unvaccinated. A joint European-Japanese spacecraft has returned its first picture of Mercury, the planet closest to the sun. The spacecraft made the first of six flybys last night. The European Space Agency says the craft captured a black-and-white image of Mercury's northern hemisphere. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, supporting human rights advocates worldwide as they respond to COVID-19 and defend democratic rights. Learn more at ajws.org and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Later in the show, we'll hear from the student journalists of Manner, Inc., reporting on the stories in their latest issue. But first, we'll check in with Leif Johansson from his podcast Close to Home, which is at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Leif checks in with Sullivan West Central School District Superintendent Stephen Walker again about an update on how his district is faring amid changing state COVID guidelines, a raging Delta variant, and a team of faculty, staff, and students that has little interest in locking back down again.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. This week, we're going to circle back to a topic that we talked about in one of our first Close to Home episodes from this past winter, education during the pandemic. And even though it would be much better to be rid of COVID-19 altogether, we are in a very different pandemic landscape than we were when we reported on this back in early February. So I wanted to get back in touch with one of our local leaders in public education to see how things are going today, now that students are back in school 5 days a week and things are looking like some version of normal, even if we are still in a pandemic. Here is Sullivan West Superintendent Steve Walker.
Now, well said. I think some version of normal is the right way to term it. I think overall people are feeling good about it. I just spent about an hour and a half walking through classrooms here at the middle and high school, and it's so heartwarming to see kids and teachers back together, collaborating, learning together. And that's what schools are about, and that's what our mission should be, is engaging students and teachers in really important learning. And that's what I saw this morning, so I'm really encouraged.
Do you get a sense of, in your rounds and in talking to students and faculty and staff alike, that people feel safe being back this year?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we fielded some questions as the overall COVID situation in our region and the state and nation sort of took another turn for the worse. We were so optimistic in June about what September was hopefully going to look like. And as things again took kind of a downturn during the summer, you could feel the level of concern increase about what it was going to look like and how we were going to be able to navigate this, as you said, with some level of normality. But I think now that, you know, folks are back and they understand that we're doing everything we can to have it be a regular school experience with masks on and with social distancing wherever and whenever we can. And folks are doing a wonderful job with that. So since kids have come back, I can say I've fielded very, very few questions with regard to health and safety protocols, as opposed to this time last year, when it was almost everything that anyone wanted to talk about.
On a similar topic of the health and safety protocols, I saw on Sullivan West's social media that you put out a letter in, I think it was early August, saying that you and your team had just found out that there was going to be essentially no guidance from the governor's office or the State Department of Health on COVID-19 protocols for the year, That sounded like it was a surprise at the time. How has that impacted the last month and a half for you?
Yeah, I think I can candidly say it's been continually frustrating for the past year and a half to not know if we were going to receive guidance, if we were going to receive a directive, if either of those answers were yes, when that was going to come about. Too many Friday night or Sunday evening course corrections because of what was coming from Albany, and then with the requirement to have pivoted by Monday morning. And so it had created this sort of uncertainty and unease among everybody, because not only was there lack of clarity about what we were supposed to be doing, but there was lack of clarity about who was kind of calling the shots, so to speak, and what principles we were using to make some of these decisions, or others were using to make these sorts of decisions. So without speaking to politics, I think the change in the governor did change the direction fairly quickly, in that upon the swearing in of Governor Hochul, she then directed the Department of Health to issue a mandate to schools with regard to mask wearing. We had already announced that all staff, students, and visitors would be wearing masks all the time anyway. But the governor then made that a state mandate and applied it everywhere. And so that, I think, was important, and I think demonstrates some principled leadership. Folks can agree or disagree about the decision, but at least there was clear leadership and direction there from the state. And that's all we've been asking for, is either give us guidance or give us a directive, but be consistent about it.
Is there any guidance either from the state or the federal level on vaccines?
There's a mandate from the state with regard to every staff member or contracted member of the faculty or staff here in any school district in New York State either has to provide proof of vaccination or provide regular and weekly testing results for COVID. And so that's something that was announced earlier this month. We're now working through the process of how to make that logistically happen, working with the faculty and staff, with an outside COVID testing provider, with the County Department of Health, and with other districts in the region. So it's, I think that's an important step too. We know that vaccines, at least in my opinion, are the key to getting us out of this really incredibly challenging year and a half that we've all had. And so we're encouraged by that step, and we're working with the faculty and staff now to get their vaccine information provided to us, and then to figure out how we can best ensure that they're tested weekly if they're not vaccinated.
Outside of vaccines or masks or some social distancing, what have been some of the biggest challenges in just getting this year off the ground so far?
I think the polarization of the discourse in general around COVID, and then more specifically around masks, and whether or not that should be a part of the regular daily experience for folks in schools, was very difficult to navigate for a long time. And I think it continues to be in a lot of places. I think fortunately in our district, perhaps because we were clear about it from the beginning, even before the mandate from the state, that we believe that was what made the most sense, because we're not epidemiologists, we're not infectious disease specialists, and so we're not going to substitute our judgment for those who are. Certainly there was some pushback that I heard regularly on that topic, but I think you have to, again, have some principles that are guiding you. And that was one of them, in my opinion, was we have to be informed by those who are the medical experts, even if it's an unpopular opinion. We're trying to do what best allows us to keep the most kids and the most faculty physically in person in our buildings every day. And as we sit here today, we've not had to, of course, close or modify our schools or our schedule due to any in-school COVID outbreak, and we feel great about that. Knock on wood.
If there is an outbreak, if one or two or a handful of students or faculty or staff members get COVID, what is the plan that's in place for that right now?
Both buildings are prepared to implement remote learning if we needed to. One of the big changes for this year from the CDC is that if students are wearing masks properly, and we've I think, demonstrated that our students do an excellent job of that over the past 18 months. If students are wearing their masks properly and are outside of 3 feet from each other, even if it's for an extended period of time, and one student tests positive, the other students are not required to quarantine. That's a big change from last year, where you saw entire bus runs or entire classrooms being quarantined for one positive case. That isn't the situation anymore. And that's really, it's an overused term, but that's a game changer for us in terms of being able to keep kids in school. And I think the number of faculty and staff who have gotten vaccinated also helps us a lot too. Because even if exposed, a faculty and staff member wouldn't have to quarantine if they're vaccinated, as long as they're not showing symptoms. You know, those are substantial changes from where we were 12 months ago, and so far have allowed us to really cut down on the amount of contact tracing that we have to do within the course of the day.
I'm glad you brought up remote learning, because I've been thinking about how there are a lot of businesses out there who, now that they are getting back to some sort of normal schedule, they've also implemented some of the scheduling and the way that they operated from the period during COVID when vaccines were not available and whatnot. So some businesses might have hybrid work schedules now, or they've just changed the way that they work in some way. Has COVID impacted how instruction and the transfer of content from educators to students works, even as we eventually move past COVID?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is yes. And I think it's impacted it in my opinion, only positive ways. I think we've now, as an entire organization, moved to a philosophy where there's an understanding that teaching and learning doesn't have to be restricted just to the brick and mortar of a classroom or a school, and just to the start and end times of a regular school day. You know, that learning can and should occur outside of those kind of rigid structures. And so what we're looking at now is the idea that, can we provide academic support, social and emotional support, counseling, even extracurriculars or music or other lessons outside of the regular school day digitally, virtually, to our kids? And one of the things that we're thinking there as we begin some planning on that concept is, most parents working the kind of normal 9-to-5 or 8-to-5 schedule aren't available for real connections with their kids as they learn, and they aren't available for connections with their kids' teachers. But running a 2 days a week, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. academic support period virtually would allow a parent potentially to connect with a teacher in a way that they otherwise might not have, and then therefore support their child learning at home. We also recognize that there are scores of kids who may need academic or social and emotional support outside of the school day just to ensure their success during the school day. And so we're interested in, can we find a way to structure that so that students legitimately understand that, you know, my learning doesn't stop, my contact with the school doesn't stop when the bell rings and I get on the bus at the end of the day. And the other side of that is, you know, because of all the work that's been done with our learning management systems, that we have so many more teachers posting information, videos, assignments to an online management system now, and saying to kids, you know, your at-home learning will be to watch this 10-minute video, consider this question, because tomorrow, instead of using 10 minutes of class time showing you the video, your at-home learning was to be prepared by having watched it to begin with, and then to come into class prepared to engage in some critical thinking around that work. You know, that's an exciting evolution in schools that I think was happening before the pandemic, but was hastened in terms of its improvement by COVID.
Hmm.
So we thank COVID for those couple of advances, for nothing else, but for those couple of advances.
For folks that aren't directly involved in our local public schools in one way or another, having parents more engaged in students' learning when students are at home, what does that actually look like in practice?
Well, I think what we'd want to see is parents having the ability to engage with their kids in discussions around, what did you learn today? Why do you think you learned it? And now what is it that you can do from home and I can do as a parent to support you doing from home that's going to increase your odds of success? And so for so long, I think parents have felt as though when kids got to, you know, even the middle school level, the content was now so nuanced and so complicated that not being able to access the instruction themselves, they didn't have a real way to support their child who might be struggling academically, and certainly didn't have, in most cases, the tools to support their child at home with strategies if they're struggling socially and emotionally. But if a parent was able to sit in on a virtual support session while their child's engaging with their teacher around how to write a compound sentence or how to handle frustration or strategies to de-escalate oneself if they're feeling anger or depression, you know, I think hopefully it will help parents to feel like they're an active part of the equation and not a bystander because of the complex nature of the learning that happens. And conversely, at the lower elementary level too, I think there are a lot of parents who would love to support their kids as they learn those early literacy skills, but don't want to be advancing practices from their kids that may be contrary to how our teachers are teaching their kids to read. So again, that opportunity to, you know, if I can, as a parent, watch the same video at home as my child that my child's teacher has asked them to watch in preparation for tomorrow's lesson, if I can see that too, I can get a sense of how my child's teacher is approaching phonemic awareness among a kindergarten class, that I can perhaps help to reinforce some of those skills in a way that I couldn't have before.
On another topic, I know that obviously in the last year and a half, state government revenue contracted significantly. There was less money to go around for schools last year. What does that look like this year? Is the school struggling to make ends meet and make sure that all the resources are there to provide students with the best education that they can get?
Yeah, that was, so you're right. There was certainly a point last winter, I guess, when there was some real significant concern about the coffers of the state and what that was going to then translate into in terms of state aid. Fortunately, I think what we've seen is that some of the tax revenue has started to come back. The projections are improving. The federal government coming through with the American Rescue Plan, that absolutely has changed the trajectory for schools throughout the state and for us as well. That injected $2.2 million or will inject $2.2 million into our funding stream over the next 3 years. And so one of the ways that we might consider paying for that kind of after-school remote support for kids and parents is through federal funds. So we feel very good about where we are financially now that the community has supported our budgets in fantastic ways over the past few years. And we also knew that we have to plan for not just what's ahead of us now, but what may be a longer-term challenge for the state financially. So we've been preparing for that.
Obviously, this period of time during COVID, I can only imagine, has been extremely difficult for you in within your role. Do you feel like you have changed or grown as a result of COVID within your position as superintendent? And if so, how?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm just a better, more principled leader now. I think that having to adjust to making decisions that are so far outside of what kind of your expertise is, and even, you know, your why you got into the business, right? I certainly didn't get into education to talk about public health pandemics and mask wearing and social distancing. None of us did, right? So I think the principles, the mental discipline, the strength and fortitude you have to face criticism over issues that are so politicized and so divisive, knowing that anytime you make a decision around one of those topics, you're going to have people who will applaud it and people who will disagree with it strongly. That is strengthening for a leader. It does hone you as a leader. And I think it's also developed my vision now that I do have a clearer vision for what 21st century schooling can look like. And it doesn't have to be a return to complete normalcy. I think normalcy while it was fine for some kids, wasn't great and engaging and interesting for all kids. And that's what school should be about, right? It's how can we engage and interest all kids? And I think the pandemic's helped us to focus more clearly on that. So that's exciting. I'm looking forward to the future of our schools.
As the COVID situation evolves, we will continue to check back in with leaders from across our community. But I know that many of us are keeping a close eye on our public education system because our schools are not just the backbone of our community, they're the backbone of our community's future. When they are open and giving young people the best possible educational experience, that is a strong investment in the future of our villages, towns, county, and beyond. So I am particularly thankful to the folks who are teaching our kids and keeping our schools open and running smoothly, and most importantly, running safely. Thank you to Sullivan West Superintendent Steve Walker for coming back on the program this week. And as always, thank you for listening. If you want to hear our previous conversation with Superintendent Walker and other Sullivan County school administrators, check out Close to Home Episode 3 from February 13th, 2021. I'm Leif Johansson, and this is Close to Home, a production of WJFF Radio Catskill. Stay safe and have a great week.
You can hear Leif's podcast Close to Home on WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, the student journalists of Manor, Inc. take over Radio Catskill.
On Catskill Character, meet Yaya DeGood. From the DR to Park Slope to the Catskills, this gal's constantly evolving and finding ways to contribute not just to her family's life, but the life of her community. Tune in Saturday at 11:30 when Yaya DeGood and me, Donna Fellenberg, question, can women really have it all? Added bonus, we talk about wigs on WJFF.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, Teen Edition. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor, Inc. Manor, Inc. is the youth-driven, community-supported monthly newspaper published by the Livingston Manor Free Library. And today, we'll be bringing you some of our stories. On today's show, businesses are open, but where are the workers? Employers are struggling to fill job positions. I speak to the Sullivan County Department of Workforce Management to find out more. Picking pronouns, redefining gender. Manor, Inc.'s Nadine Osborne and Michelle Adam Thomas report on gender fluidity during LGBT plus History Month. Plus, reviews of He's All That and Shang-Chi. And my letter from the editor. National press reports have abounded lately concerning the problems that a wide range of employers have had with filling their staffing needs, resulting in critical shortages of nurses, truck drivers, construction and warehouse workers, and more. Locally, similar reports have emerged as schools, bus companies, contractors, and restaurants have unfulfilled positions. I spoke with Lauren Gebeline, the director of the Department of Workforce Management in Sullivan County. The department's mission is to work with employers to train persons who need skills and assistance obtaining jobs.
Have you been noticing employment issues in Sullivan County?
I'm sorry, say that again. Have I been noticing what?
Have you been noticing employment issues in Sullivan County?
Oh, major. Major, especially through the pandemic over the last, you know, year and a half. We've still, to this point, got almost 4,000 people on unemployment in Sullivan County. you know, we also work with businesses as well in the county that reach out to us looking for staff. You know, so we try to put them in our system, match up skill sets, you know, refer people over to a certain, you know, to a business that's hiring. But our businesses are in major need. You know, during COVID, during the pandemic, our public assistants in the county, we could not mandate them to job search, look for jobs, anything. That the state took that mandation off in August. So now we're allowed to, you know, make the people that are on public assistance job search and search for jobs and update their resumes and, you know, have meetings with us, orientations, all that. So that started up again only within the past, you know, 3 weeks, a month, I would say. You know, so that hopefully will probably, I'm hoping we're going to see a little bit of an uptick, you know, within the next few weeks. We should be seeing a little something. But my main concern is that pretty much through COVID, I think we've lost anywhere from 30% to 40% of the women in the workforce. I think a lot of the women, you know, are staying home, raising their children, homeschooling their children, or sending them back to school wondering when the school is going to close back down.
Yeah.
And with child care issues in the county the way they are, you know, there's not enough child care out there. So I think a lot of the women have decided, you know what, I don't know that I can go back to work.
Yeah.
So, you know, out of that 4,000, I mean, there's, you know, I don't have the exact figures of men versus women in that 4,000, but, you know, I'm going to say at least 30 to 40%, and that's hard right now. It's, you know, a lot of the positions that you see open are a lot of things that, jobs that, you know, a lot of women would take, especially while they've got younger children. You know, like with the companies that are out there, you know, waitressing and bartending and, you know, store clerks or office work, you know. Not that men can't do it, but men seem to go for a lot of the different jobs. So those seem to be the jobs that are really in demand right at the moment. One of the hard things, I think, within Sullivan County is, you know, during the pandemic, too, a lot of the businesses have closed. You know, I'm not sure where we stand right at the moment with the amount of people that are in the county. But a lot of our stuff, a couple of our mandatory partners are no longer holding or maintaining offices within the county. So in order to get something, we have to send them out to Orange County, which is, we're included in the Mid-Hudson region. You know, we've lost some of the training ability that we had within the county and other things that we could offer. And also, through this right now, there's a lot of virtual training. The college is finally open up, but that just started a couple weeks ago. You know, we do not have adult education to offer within Sullivan County. You know, that used to be held by BOCES, but that's not being offered. And that hasn't, actually, that was prior to the pandemic even. You know, the college is open, but prior, you know, a lot of people, I think, do not like virtual trainings. I know myself, I don't think that I would want to do that because I need, like, hands-on and I need to hear and see somebody training me and be able to do, you know. So I think a lot of the virtual services that are out right now, a lot of people don't want to do, and you're thinking about it, you've got the people that are really the unemployed right now are between the ages, your main place is between age 30 and 55 or older, 35 and up. A lot of these people, especially the older, don't know how to use computers like some of the younger people do. So that's also, you know, thrown into the mix here of, you know, I don't know if I want to take virtual training because not really good with the computer. We can assist people with computers, and that's what our career center does here. And, you know, we can at least even help somebody do that. It's not like they have to be eligible to walk in our door. I mean, there are eligibility requirements for us to spend money, but that, you know, our doors are still here in order to show people how to do things as well. We're located, our career center is located at 50 North Street, Monticello. We are in a building with the Department of Labor. Because the Department of Labor, which is state, is not allowed to see people, and they are the leaseholder of this building, we can't open our doors fully except by appointment only. So, you know, we're still facing struggles, too, trying to get people in. Our unemployment rate did drop. I think we're at 5.2% right now for the month of August. But, you know, from down significantly, but that's, you know, still 4,000 people within the county.
Have there been any businesses that have been hit harder than others with unemployment issues?
Any businesses? It's not been discriminatory, I'll tell you that. It's hit everybody. You know, it has hit every business as far as the health care to the food service to the, you know, auto mechanics to the small mom and pop shops. It's affected everybody. We have we list on our website, which our website is SullivanWorks.org. On there, we feature hot jobs. So if you go on that site and go down to hot jobs, you'll see every business that has in the county that contacts us looking for assistance. Now, not everybody in the county reaches out to us, that's for sure, but a lot of them do. We do what we can to go into our computer systems and our business service team matches skill sets for the business of what they're looking for. And then email blast will go out to, you know, how many of our people are on that list, and, you know, telling them that, hey, this matches your skill set. You know, here's a job opening we're referring to you. You know, but it's up to the people to apply. We can't go hold people's hand and make them apply for a job. So, you know, our money goes out to try to get people into these trainings and, you know, upskill them. And, you know, especially right now with a lot of the people that are dislocated, you know, they've lost their job in the pandemic. Maybe they don't want to go back into that. We're here to, we'll teach you something totally different if that's what you want to do and get you a resume. I mean, we have somebody here on staff that does resume building with people. I think another hindrance right now is, you know, we're seeing it all over the news, you know, where a lot of the healthcare even, you know, does not want to get the mandated vaccines that don't want to be mandated. So I think that mandation is holding some people back from work too. You know, if they've been staying home all of this time, like I said, I think there's a lot of people out there that are afraid to go back to work thinking they might get sick. There is people that don't want to be mandated to take a vaccine. So they're afraid that they might not get a job done. You know, there's so many different variances right now of what is going on. I truthfully, and where we're at right now, I don't think that we're going to see many changes until at least the spring. You know, a lot of people in this area don't want to drive during the winter. Why am I going to go back to work? Why do, you know, maybe they just didn't even like their job, but I mean, we can help them change their career pathway if that's what they want to do. You know, we're here, like I said, even if we can't pay for their training, but I mean, if they're dislocated and not working, that pretty much qualifies them for our programs. So, you know, and then you've got the other uptick of, you know, the opioid crisis, which is huge right now. You know, I sit on a task force with that as well, trying to figure out where our youth are within the county and, you know, try to get them, you know, if they quit school or whatever, and try to get them a GED, try to get them, you know. Our main goal, like I said, is to make everybody part of society.
This is Radio Chatskill, Teen Edition. I'm Osi Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. Observed during October in the United States, Canada, and Australia, LGBT plus History Month represents the origin of Pride and what it means to support and respect LGBT plus individuals in our community. While this demographic of people has always existed throughout history, there has only recently been a wave of LGBT plus acceptance throughout America, popularizing a plethora of queer vocabulary as well as adding new terms to the dictionary. In order to gain a deeper insight into the experiences of LGBT plus youth, Manor Inc.'s Nadine Osborne spoke to Mars Madison, former editor of Manor Inc., who identified as transgender and mainly goes by he-him pronouns.
Is gender identity important to you, and how would you explain your answer?
I would say gender identity is very important to me, probably because my gender identity does not align with what I was assigned at birth. So I would say it's pretty important, yeah.
What pronouns do you use? Would you identify as transgender, non-binary, or other?
Yeah, I go by he and they now. Yeah, I would say trans, just because I kind of tend to use umbrella terms. You know, I'm like, meh. I don't necessarily need to label anything, but, you know, like sometimes I'll just be like, oh, I'm gay, even though I'm not actually like straight up gay. I just use it as an umbrella term, which if it works, it works. But like, I would say I say trans. That's probably like basic for me.
Next question. What does gender mean to you?
I think it kind of just means expressing yourself and how you present, you know, like, I feel like it's just expressing yourself. It's fun, you know, because gender identity doesn't necessarily have to correlate to gender expression, but I think that they do definitely like correlate most of the time. I don't know.
How would you describe how it feels to be trans to a cis person?
Ooh. I always use this example. I don't know if this is going to answer the question. Please tell me if it doesn't.
Give it a go.
But I always say, like, you know, people are always like, how did you know you were trans? And I'm like, okay, picture this. If your head was detached from your body and you didn't have, like, you just were a head and you didn't have a body, would you still know that you were whatever gender you are? Like, if you were, you know, like, let's say it's a man who was assigned male at birth and identifies as a man. If they were detached from their body, would they still know that they were a man, even if they didn't have the body of a man? You know what I'm saying? So it's more of like a mental thing than what's attached to your person. I don't know if that answers that question, but that's what I always say.
For some reason, when you started that statement, I expected you to say, it reminds me of this one image I saw of BoJack Horseman and Pinkie Pie, except their heads are switched, and the caption is, "This is what gender dysphoria looks like." I have no clue how accurate that is, but I thought it was just really funny that that's what jumped into my mind immediately.
That's great. I love that.
It's fantastic, and also deeply unsettling.
A little bit, but it's okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say like most of the discomfort probably comes by like, you know, knowing something in your head, but like everyone telling you one thing and you being in a certain body and it's just, it doesn't make sense. Like you feel one thing inside.
What do you wish other people knew about gender identity?
I would say I wish people knew that it's okay to question it and that you probably should question it, even if you're not like uncomfortable in your body. You should be like, is what society is telling me what I actually feel? Or is what everyone around me telling me what I actually feel? I think it's something that, like, if you question your gender identity, you will just get more in touch with yourself, and you'll just learn more about yourself and how you want to express yourself. I'm not saying that everyone should ask themselves, am I transgender? But, you know, like, everyone should be like, I don't have to conform to social norms or gender norms. And just, like, you know, figure yourselves out. I think, like, people get so stuck in, like, history, how people have presented in history and how, like, the different genders have presented in history, that, like, it baffles them if a man wears a dress, you know? And it's, like, the end of the world for them. And it's, like, it's just fabric.
Just fabric that you use to... Clothes exist so that you can cover your body, because that's socially acceptable.
Exactly.
Like...
Exactly.
It's not that deep. I once heard that like back in like the 19 or 1800s or something, kids aged 1 to 7, like boys or girls, would just wear like frocks, like basically just nightgowns or like dresses. And then once they hit a certain age, they would like not wear those anymore. But then clothing companies thought of this brilliant idea to get people to buy more clothes, and they were like, hey, what if we make it specific to gender so that you can't reuse clothes for different children? Like, there can't be hand-me-downs because boys can't wear pink and girls can't wear blue. Like, they just threw a wrench in the gears for the sake of making more money, and it stuck.
They're like, brilliant marketing tactic. Brilliant, yeah. It's dumb.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's basically the same thing as, like, making a specific clothing line for people with brown hair.
If you put something in someone's head, then they're gonna think that. But like, if you tell someone, you know, women aren't as good as men,
they're gonna internalize it.
Believe it. Yeah, and then people are gonna start acting that way. So it's like, that's, sexism is taught and it's like ingrained in society, and then like also racism and all that kind of stuff is like ingrained in society because people, like, someone decided one day, oh, this gender isn't as good, you know, this skin color isn't as good as everyone else. And it's like, it's all made up and it's stupid and terrible.
And like, everyone in their whole lives starts out as an impressionable kid. And like, you could tell a kid that the sun is going to explode in a week, and they will believe you because they have no frame of reference for whether things are like realistically plausible or not. So if you tell them that this gender is worse or this race is worse, like, it doesn't even have to be you explicitly saying it. It can just be like subtle things, like seeing racism in TV shows or seeing like even just a lack of representation of Black characters in TV shows.
Or really them always being like the butt of a joke.
Yeah, the butt of a joke.
You know, then it's like that goes into your brain and you like internalize that and retain it.
Yeah. Or if they are represented, but only in like one singular portrayal that's like not the best, aka a stereotype.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's like,
yeah,
it's just ridiculous. But when I was 4 years old, I thought that it was illegal for women to be the lead in movies. Because I had never seen a movie with a female lead.
Oh my god. That's really sad.
I know. I thought that it just wasn't allowed. Because...
Yeah, exactly. But then it's like, you know, kids think that. And then they might grow up like, well, women can't be leads in movies because I've never seen one. That's funny. Like, not to pick on you, but that's great.
It's hilarious and also tragic because, like, kids are dumb and they'll believe things that are not the best to believe.
It kind of, like, to tie back into, like, gender identity and stuff, it's like, you can't blame someone for not knowing something, you know? Yeah. Nobody's born knowing everything. So, like, people who literally have no idea what people are talking about when they say like gender identity or like transgender, they might not have any idea, but like, you know, they have to go out of their way to learn about it. They can't continue to be ignorant. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's okay if you're ignorant to something, but if you continue to be ignorant about it, then that's what the issue is. So, you know, if you're a 4-year-old kid who doesn't think women can be the leads in movies, you grow up and you learn.
Yeah,
you know,
that's exactly. Okay. And sometimes you grow up and those ideas get like reaffirmed as you grow up. And as mm-hmm. you become more independent, you start to think like, hey, I can speak for myself now. Why don't I regurgitate these ideas that are in my mind onto other people and just continue the cycle? Yeah.
And that's why representation matters. Because
exactly.
Then you learn things.
You
and
learn,
you learn that it's okay to like feel the things.
You learn that like these people are literally just like you, and that the differences are so superficial that they don't even matter.
Exactly.
You are listening to Radio Chatskill, Teen Edition. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. And here's my review of the Netflix film, He's All That.
They get worse. These movies keep getting worse. They're not even hiring actors anymore. They're just social media stars now. My mental health seems to be taking a toll from watching these movies. The new Netflix original movie, He's All That, is a reimagining of the 1999 movie She's All That. It's about a popular social media influencer trying to turn an outcast into a prom king hottie as a challenge after she gets cheated on by her boyfriend, who is also an influencer, and her follow count plummets. I cannot tell you how awful this movie was. There were only 2 decent actors in the entire film. Everyone else was comically bad. Even during serious scenes, the characters acted like they were in a YouTube skit, not a network movie. Every interaction between people was agonizing to witness. This might be the worst movie I've seen. The music was average, and the camera work wasn't the worst, but there was only 1 montage, and it was 1 montage too many. I confess I only like training montages. But there are some things in He's All That that made me laugh. But the joy derived from those moments was negligible. I think it's time to put rom-coms to rest. There was nothing good about this film. I didn't like any of the characters. They were such cheesy, cliched caricatures of teenagers. And all the actors suffered from the classic, I'm portraying a kid in high school, but I'm obviously in my late 20s syndrome that plagues much of the media we consume. I rate it a 2 stars out of 10. Watch this movie and suffer the consequences of society.
Now here is my colleague Nadine Osborne's take.
He's All That is a cringeworthy, cliched catastrophe of a movie, the viewing experience of which I may never recover from. Let me start from the beginning. From the opening scene of this movie, during which the main character picks up her phone and begins live streaming the literal moment she wakes up, I knew I was in for a rough ride. This film's most glaring flaw is its portrayal of high school and the teenagers that attend it. As a teenager myself, I feel no affinity towards the 25-year-old supermodels with washboard abs who pretend to be my age. Social media, looks, and popularity seem to consume their every waking thought, to the point where they are removed of their character. While some high schoolers like me do share these concerns, they do not govern our entire lives. We have flaws, personalities, dreams, and aspirations. These people have none of those things. They're each more two-dimensional than a sheet of gold leaf, which is not a good sign when you're expected to care enough about them to sit through an hour and a half of their shenanigans. The key character in this movie who deviates from this norm is eventually made out to be a popular, conventionally attractive love interest, abandoning any shred of nuance or personality he once had. While this film does touch upon some more important topics such as LGBT relationships, the deceptiveness of social media, and toxic friendships, they carry almost no weight because they're part of such a shallow and vapid movie. Do yourself a favor and avoid He's All That like the plague.
And here's my review of the film Shang-Chi.
I've been a fan of superheroes for a long time. When I was younger, I would read a lot of comics, watch TV shows, and go see the movies. I'm now more of a fan of martial arts, but I still follow the MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe. So the movie I just witnessed might have come out at the best time for me personally. perfect mix of martial arts and superpowers. That's the best way to describe Shang-Chi in The Legend of the Ten Rings. This film has everything going for it. Great comedic timing, acting, CGI creature designs, characterizations, plot, camera work, music, and of course, fight choreography. The first fight scene in which we see the titular character serves to demonstrate how amazing this movie is. The moves are so solid and swift, you may be surprised to learn that the actor Simu Liu had no prior martial arts experience. He started from scratch and obviously built up solid skills. The perfectly timed music really helped boost the quality of the fight. Sadly, the quality declined somewhat throughout the movie, but that's not to say the other fights weren't pretty heckin' epic, because they were. The costume designs were also dope. They tied the action together nicely. You could really tell that everyone was having fun with this movie, a quality that typically makes a movie more enjoyable. The characters were unique, funny, and unconventional. There weren't many cliches, and the ones that were there were done well. I rate Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings a 9 out of 10 stars. It was a really good movie, and I strongly suggest you check it out. And here's my colleague Nadine Osborne's take.
I'm pleased to say that Shang-Chi isn't the cookie-cutter, time-wasting Marvel movie I first expected it to be. It is instead a visual cornucopia of dazzling mythological creatures, action-packed fight scenes, and likable characters that are easy to become invested in. It subverted my expectations in a way that most superhero movies haven't managed to, or simply don't try to. Oftentimes, I would predict a cliche before it happened, only for my expectations to be subverted when I was instead met with a joke refuting that exact cliche. Many of these jokes also maintain the flow of the movie well, supplementing the action instead of drawing it to a screeching halt. It got several genuine laughs out of me, which is more than I can say for many other films. My absolute favorite aspect, however, was the creature design, which took heavy inspiration from Chinese mythology and presented it in a visually stunning way that reflects the best of modern CGI. It was nothing short of stellar, to the point where my jaw legitimately dropped when the first of these mythological creatures appeared on screen. Even given all its successes, I wouldn't claim that Shang-Chi is a masterpiece or my favorite movie of all time, but it's certainly the most fun viewing experience I've had in a long time. Even if you're not particularly interested in Marvel or martial arts movies, there is much enjoyment to be had here. Go watch Shang-Chi. You'll be pleasantly surprised.
This is Radio Chatsko, Teen Edition. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. Before we go, here's my letter from the editor. To continue with our front page theme of gender identity, I would like to share a few of my own thoughts. Many cisgendered folks don't seem to understand trans people. For those who don't know, cisgender is the term used to describe people whose gender identity matches with their biological sex. While none of us can truly understand what the experience is like, there are people who use that as a way to justify dismissing trans folks. They say things like, "What do you mean you feel like a guy or feel like a girl?" Because they've lived their lives without that dysphoria and have a body that matches their mind. So of course, they couldn't fathom not feeling another way. As I'm cisgender, I have no idea what it feels like to not have your body match how you truly are. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. People need to stop assuming that just because they don't get it, or understand it, or haven't experienced it, that it gives them the right to attack others and dismiss their identities. That's all for Radio Chatsko, Teen Edition. Special thanks to David Dan, Art Steinhauer, Diana Fredenberg, Amy Himes, Taylor Jaffe, Daniel Morton, and everyone involved with Manor Inc. You can find more information about Manor Inc. at manor-inc.org. Radio Chatsko Teen Edition is produced in partnership with WJFF Radio Catskill and Mosey Helper. Thank you for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville. We are Radio Catskill.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org